What's up, guys? It's Matresa and Nick, and we are back for Strength 101. Today, we have our Q&As. So we got a bunch of questions on our Instagram, so we're excited to answer those today.
And while you're getting settled in to listen to this, please hit that subscribe button, follow button, whatever button is there, so that we know that we're giving you guys some value, that's good feedback for us, and also, you'll get notified when we put out new podcasts, and you don't want to miss great information. So, let's get into it.
Bada bing, bada boom. All right, our first question is from AngieTurner781. Shout out, Angie. Her question is, macros, cutting versus building, is it possible to do both simultaneously? So first of all, first part of that is macros. So macros are three sources of energy that we take in, which is going to be our proteins, fats, and carbs. So I would say if you're tracking on macros, that's going to be a little bit more strict. Otherwise, there's calories in, calories out, which I know we've talked about a little bit in some of our past podcasts. But what that's going to look like is just simply tracking your calories. And that's going to be not as strict, focusing more maybe just on protein and calories, not focusing on the macros. So for cutting and building, though, so if you want to know what cutting is going to be where you're taking in less calories and you're trying to shed off some body fat. As building or bulking, you might also hear, is going to be taking in more calories than you're burning. So we're trying to focus on muscle building, and you will be gaining a little bit of body fat in that as well. Can you do both simultaneously? If you want to see like good results and like whatever your goals are going to be, I would say no. I think you have to focus on just one or the other to get strong results from either one of them. It's hard to lose body fat while you're trying to bulk at the same time. So I would say that whatever your goals are, it'd be better to probably just focus on one or the other.
Yeah, certainly. I think if you're new to this terminology, it can be very confusing. If somebody says that they're tracking macros and somebody says they're counting calories, those are largely the same thing, just different levels of strictness, right? We're huge advocates for counting calories and also tracking protein. So we ask them to track one macronutrient, but not all of them. And the reason that I'm such a big advocate for that is because I don't want to give more reasons for somebody to fail. There's so much strictness when you tell yourself you have to eat a certain amount of grams of carbohydrates and a certain amount of grams of fat that it can feel really restrictive when you're trying to do something that's already difficult to do.
For sure.
And so if we can get people just to do calories and protein, then they're going to get the same results without feeling like they have no freedom in their life. And then, you know, when you're looking at the cutting versus building side of that, largely your protein intake is going to be the same in either one of those scenarios. There's not a huge benefit to getting more protein in. Like if I get in 200 to 225 grams of protein a day, I'm not going to grow muscle faster or recover better because I got in 300 grams. My body just needs what it needs, and it's actually going to break down that extra protein and just basically turn it into a carbohydrate. So it's unnecessary. And so when you're looking at cutting versus building, the protein's going to be about the same. And then all we do is we start to taper down how much carbs and fat we eat. And that's a lot easier, and you have a lot more freedom if you're only focused on the total calories and the protein. You know, there are obviously people who need to hone in on specific fats, and specific carbohydrates, like bodybuilders, people who are really going for a specific look to their body. But for the general person, I don't think it's necessary.
For sure not.
Well, one thing I would like to mention on that too, is if you are bulking, like, and I've tried to bulk so often in my life, and for me personally, when I'm bulking, I have to hit something like 4,500, 5,000 calories a day if I really want to put on weight. And so when you're deciding how much carbs and fat to eat, I do think it's beneficial if you're trying to bulk to eat more fats, because they're just a higher density of calories. And so then you don't have to eat as much volume of food through the day. If you were trying to eat a low fat diet and you're trying to get in 5,000 calories, you're just going to be eating like 7 large meals a day, and it's just going to be so overwhelming, you can't do it. And on the flip side, if you're cutting, then we always try to teach people to volumize their food. And maybe they are going to eat a little bit lower fat, not zero fat, but a little bit lower fat, so that they get more quantity of food throughout their day.
If you're wondering what like volume eating is, that's going to be like your lettuce, cauliflower, rice, things that are low in calorie, but you can have a bunch of that's still going to stay low calorie. So it seems like it's a lot of how much can you chew, right? You get a lot more bites out of volumized eating that way.
Yeah. So I think to summarize, like if you're worried about like that you're going to miss out on results because you're not counting your macros, I don't think that's right for most people. I think if you focus on calories and protein, you're going to get all the results you want.
For sure. And decide what's better for you, if you'd rather bulk or build or cut.
So next question comes from Ab Bauman in through the Instagram. Is training at percentages only for barbell work? How do I maximize gains in class work? And this is a member of our gym, and we do strength training in class format, so it is pretty specific to what we're doing. And I would say, and this is a two-part question. I'll read the second part of the question later, but is training at percentages only for barbell work? It's not only for barbell work. There's definitely, you could train at percentages. And what she means by this is there's a lot of people that will go into the gym and they'll say, I'm going to hit, you know, 5 reps today at 80% of my 1 rep max. And that's really a really good way for them to make sure that they are training at the proper intensity every time that they go in, whether they're not feeling good or they're feeling amazing, so that they don't overtrain when they're feeling amazing and so that they don't undertrain when they're just not feeling it that day. So it keeps them on a pretty strict schedule. I would say that unless you're training for something that's really truly a skill in strength and you're probably gonna be competitive with it, I think that it's, once again, unnecessary strictness on your training. And so, yes, you could do that with dumbbell training. You could do it with kettlebell training. You can definitely do it with barbell training. But unless you have a specific goal where you're actually going to compete in a squat or a deadlift or a bench, I just don't think it's necessary. And the second part of that question is, well, if you're not tracking percentages and figuring out what weights to use, how do you maximize your gains in classwork? And that's back to our standard framework of pushing close to failure. And so, Matresa, what do we always tell people for strength and for pump work on how you push to failure?
Yeah, so thinking about, like, if you had 2 reps left in the tank is always what I like to think of. Like, could you have gotten, like, 2 more? And, like, if not, then, you know, then you're right at that threshold to...
And that's for strength work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you're below 8 reps, you're doing some of those bigger, heavier exercises like your squats, your bench, your deadlift, and you are pushing some heavy weight. We teach our classes to go for a challenging weight where when they're finishing, let's say you're going for 8 reps, you should feel like maybe you could have gotten 9 or 10, but it would have been a little bit sloppy. It would have been a little bit dicey, but 8 was really strong. And that's a good place where you're going to get your strength work in. You're going to send the signal to the muscle that it needs to grow and get stronger. Now, if you're doing some higher rep work, so pump work, let's say you're doing bicep curls or lateral raises up in the ranges of like 10 and above, so like 15 reps, then you want to push those as close to failure as possible. There's very little injury risk, and those are smaller muscles, so you have to fatigue them fully. And so you should only stop on those exercises when either the burn is so much that you just have to stop, mm-hmm. or you fail the rep.
Right.
There is a second part to this question. She actually sent in 2 questions. And so the next one is, should I push to, and this is perfect, should I push to failure in every single workout, or should I leave room for recovery for later in the cycle? Now, I think the base answer to this is you can't forget that you can only train as hard as you can recover. And so really how hard you train, whether that's in a single workout over the course of weeks and months, really depends on how hard you can recover. And I would say that's how hard you can recover both physically and mentally from the workouts. And so if we were to go into the gym and push a workout to failure and it's going to compromise our workouts for the rest of the week, then I would say, no, you shouldn't push to failure in every single workout. However, there are some people, and I'm thinking of Coach DJ at our gym, who legitimately pushes himself close to puking and failing every single day. And he shows up the next day with a smile on his face, full mobility, just amazing, mm-hmm. you know, and that's because he's eating properly, he's getting a bunch of sleep, and he's young. And so mm-hmm. that makes a big difference. And so it really has to be up to the individual, and you have to almost test this out on yourself and figure out what's best for you. I know that when we train a 4-week training program, if I were to start week 1 and we were doing lunges, if I hadn't done those in 8 weeks, that we hadn't done lunges for 8 weeks, and I was like, oh, I know that last time we did lunges, I put 70 pounds in each hand for a set of 4 on each side. I'm not going to reach for that on week 1 of that program because, one, I'm probably detrained a little bit, mm-hmm. and I do want to leave a little bit in the tank to be able to ramp up over the course of that program, you know, partially because if I were to put that weight on my body, it's going to crush me, and my joints are going to start hurting, and I want to be able to not just do 1 workout that week, but do 3 workouts to maximum effectiveness.
For sure. By week 4, then, I bet you can do more than the 70s at that point, right?
Yeah. So. And really, you need to be honest with where you are at in life on this stuff. Mm-hmm. Because if you're, you know, if you're 40 years old and you have a stressful job and a stressful home like life, your sleep is compromised, and you don't get enough protein in, then you should not be pushing to failure in every workout because the recovery is just going to be so slow. So it might be better during that time of your life to go in and go 80% and feel good the next day. Mm-hmm. One of our favorite members, Warren, who's been at the gym ever since we started, my favorite thing that he says is I'll be like, hey, how heavy are you going to bench today? I'll ask him. And he'll just kind of look at me and he'll say, I just want to show up tomorrow. And that's his big thing because he knows that consistency is key. Mm-hmm. So if he pushes it to failure at the age of 50, he's going to be 56 soon. We have the same birthday, fun fact. But he'll be 56 soon. And if he trains to failure, then he's going to be hampered for the rest of the week. But if you're 22 years old, that might not be the case.
Absolutely. So yeah, I mean, that goes all the way back to you can only train as hard as you can recover. Beautiful. Thanks, Abby.
Okay, so Ross also wrote in. So Ross is also a member at the gym. And he asked, how to combat joint pain during training? Do you push through or do you change the exercise? And he's specifically referring to tendonitis and maybe some bursitis. Any type of injury, when somebody comes to me and says, this is hurting, especially if it's related to a joint, let's say like your elbow hurts or your shoulder hurts or your knees hurt, and that's usually where most people feel some pain. My first question is always, okay, is this an issue with the joint or is this being caused by tight tissue? And I would say most of the time it's a tight tissue issue. And mostly because like if you just are doing regular exercises and there was no traumatic occurrence, like you weren't bench pressing and you felt a pop in your shoulder or you heard some type of tearing sound or you just had some type of like traumatic fall and then you're not really sure what happened, then likely the joint is not the problem. And the only way you can tell that is by going in seeing a professional for that where you can get imaged and they can tell you whether there's actual damage to the ligaments around the joint. Otherwise, you're probably dealing with just some tissue tightness, maybe some tissue irritation from overtraining. And in that case, you should not push through that because your body is already telling you that that tissue is angry because it's overstressed. And if you continue to push it, it's not going to get better. It's only going to get more irritated. Yeah. What do you tell people? If you have pain yourself, like, what do you do about it? Because you're largely uninjured. I haven't seen you be hampered by many injuries.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
Yeah, no kidding, right? I would say, though, with that, even if it was myself or someone, first thing I'd do is, question it. And then most likely I would always change the exercise. So I'm giving them a nice modification. Just then at least they're still moving their body, but they're not hampering on that spot that's bugging them.
Yeah.
And I would do the same thing for myself as well.
Yeah. And when we talk about tissue either being irritated or if it's damaged, like there's a minor tear, then the best thing to do is to get blood flow to that area because that's what's going to heal it. And so, you know, you'll hear people say motion is lotion, blood flow is healing. And you really want to think about it that way. There's going to be a threshold where if you have some injured tissue, if you go above that threshold, it's going to fight back on you. But there may be a threshold you can get under where you can get movement to it without gaining irritation. And that's really where you want to sit. What I'll often tell people is if you can do this movement and the pain is no greater than a 3 or a 4 and you don't notice that the irritation is getting worse by doing it, then you should continue to move and it's going to heal over time. However, if it does get more irritated or more inflamed afterwards, then you may have to go even lighter on that exercise and check your ego. And that's usually the best way to do it. Or you can change the exercise. There's plenty of examples where, let's say somebody is having shoulder irritation and we're doing some type of overhead press. And the overhead press really is irritating above that 3 to 4, and it doesn't seem to be getting better, then you can take them down to an incline bench press. And so they're still getting similar muscle groups, but in a different angle, and it may be just enough for you to get out of that pain zone and still be able to get blood flow to the area.
Sure. I would say with that, like what he's explaining, don't be afraid of wherever you are. If you come to our gym or any gym, don't be afraid to ask for modifications on that because it's better to ask instead of just pushing through and then something worse happening.
Yeah, totally. And if you have injured tissue and you just rest it, it might feel better, but then right when you go back into movement, it's probably going to still be irritated. And so you really have to convince the body that it's okay and that it's safe to go to these positions. And then slowly over time, convince the body that it's okay to go up in load. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to baby it a little bit. But if you can do that, you can get out of injuries very quickly. It's the people that are a little bit hard-headed. And as soon as they feel a little bit better, they go and they jump up 40 pounds to what they were doing before that all of a sudden end up re-injured again.
Yes, if not worse.
One thing I would say specifically about tendonitis is tendonitis is inflammation of the tendon, and that can be from overuse. When a tendon is inflamed, it's also very sensitive. And so sometimes it's very helpful to get the tendon out of the inflammation cycle. And I'm not a doctor, so please do not take my medical advice on this. But often what we'll tell people is that some low-level ibuprofen that you can get over the counter, so like Advil or ibuprofen generic, can be really helpful on that. And that you want to take at a low level and frequently. So often I'll ask people to do 200 milligrams, you know, three times a day for over the course of 3 to 4 days. And often that can bring the irritation at that joint or irritation in that tendon down enough so that they can get effective movement again and heal the right way. There's a lot on that.
That was good though. So thanks, Ross. All right, our next question is from Don. So Don said, I was told we all have a set weight that our bodies want to be at. Nick, I'm gonna have you start on this because of your set point theory.
Yeah, do you remember, because she said, didn't she say there was a place that told her
this? Yeah, specifically it was Optavia.
And they do, that's a weight loss place? Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, so. I believe it's an online weight loss place, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. So it's not, I think that this could easily be used for some people as like a cop-out, whether that's an individual saying like, oh, my body wants to be at a certain body weight and so therefore I can't make a change, or by a coach or an organization, if somebody's not getting results, being like, well, you know, technically there's, and it's not technical. So what she's talking about in this question is something that we call set point theory. And I want to underline the word theory here, okay? This is not proven, this is a theory. And honestly, set point theory is really ill-defined. But basically what she's saying and what this organization was saying to her is that your body has a predetermined weight or body fat level that it wants to stay at. And so as soon as you start to move outside of that, whether that's losing weight or gaining weight, your body will make hormonal changes to fight to get back into its home range. And this is based around the concept of homeostasis. You know, we probably all kind of remember that word from seventh grade biology class, yeah. Which basically means that the body wants to be the same all the time, mm-hmm. and it's going to always make adjustments to be there. That's true. However, I think it's important to know like why this happens. So do you care if I go into this hormonal stuff here?
Yeah, I think you should.
Okay. All right. We're going to get a little technical here, so bear with me. I'm going to make it quick. So there's two main hormones at play when you talk about hunger and body fat loss. So we'll talk about it as body fat loss. So what the set point theory says is like basically that let's say I was to start losing weight, that my body is going to uptick my hunger signals to try to drive me to eat more food. And it may even bring down my metabolism so that I burn less energy so that I can get back to my normal body fat. That does happen to a certain extent. For example, we do know that as your body breaks down fat, your hunger is going to increase. Anybody who's gone on a cut, this is extremely true. You know, as you drop weight, your hunger just drives through the roof and it's really something you have to fight with, and there's a really good hormonal reason for that. So when your fat cells produce a hormone called leptin. And so the more fat that is being stored in your body, the more leptin is being produced. And leptin basically shuts down another hormone called ghrelin, and that's your hunger hormone. And so if your body fat is rising, your hunger decreases. Makes sense, right? Your body is basically saying, hey, you're putting on body fat. You don't have to go search for as much food. On the opposite side of that, if you start breaking down body fat, then leptin drops in the body and ghrelin increases. And ghrelin's that hunger hormone, so your hunger goes through the roof mm-hmm. because your body's saying, hey, you're losing body fat. Your body just wants you to be safe, mm-hmm. saying, hey, this isn't safe. We want those extra reserve stores. Go find some food. And so just me saying that, you may assume that just the lower body fat you get, the hungrier you would be all the time. But we don't see that, right? Somebody who loses 100 pounds is not like 100 times hungrier when they lose the 100th pound than they were when they lose the first pound.
Right.
And I'm going to use some anecdotal evidence here and talk about Chris M. from the gym, who went through a big cut with us and he lost a good 40 pounds. And then, he probably took about 6 months off and now he's doing another cut. And what he told us the other day was, I was surprised that this second time around as I'm doing this cut, I'm actually less hungry than I was the first time around. And so your body does adjust to that weight loss over time. Maybe not immediately you're going to be very hungry, but over time it does adjust. And so the way I want you guys to think about this is kind of like a thermostat. And so on a thermostat, you have a set point that you set the heat to, and when it gets above, the heat shuts off, and when it gets below, then the heat turns on, and your body's the same way. Now, after you've spent a decent amount of time at a lower body fat, your body will move that set point, and that will become your new norm. Of course, then if you push it farther, you're going to get hungry again, but it can reset. And so largely, I would say if somebody is telling you that you can't lose weight because of this, that's a bunch of hogwash.
Hogwash.
Yeah, hogwash.
Point blank period.
Point blank period. Well, there was one more thing on here I wanted to touch base on. I'm trying to remember what it was. Let's see here. Oh, the concept that your metabolism lowers as you diet and as you lose weight. Now, this is true. There's pretty strong evidence that over prolonged dieting, let's say like 12, 16 weeks, 20 weeks, the longer you go out, your body does slowly and minorly drop your metabolism. And we don't know. These are all theories. But the reasoning behind this is that your body is basically adapting to your new eating style. And so it doesn't want to run out of energy completely. And so it's going to slightly lower your metabolism. What you do to solve that is you take diet breaks, right? Maybe you go on an 8-week cut, and then after you're done, you go 4 weeks where you eat at maintenance, you allow that metabolism to heal. I hate that term, but let that metabolism heal, and then you can go on a cut again. And so it's not like there's some type of permanent thing happening in your body that's trying to keep you from losing weight.
For sure.
That's a deep one, but Dawn, that's a great question.
Yeah, no, it was awesome. So thanks, Dawn.
Hey guys, we had so many amazing questions from you that we had to split this into two parts. So this is part one. Make sure that you subscribe to this podcast so that you will get notified when part two posts next week. We'll catch you on the flippity flop. Why the f*** did I say that?
I don't know.
Everything was fine.